Weird Realities explores the paranormal, preternatural, and supernatural worlds that surround us. Here we delve into those topics that challenge us to think outside the limitations of realism, where we test the boundaries of imagination and are forced to think outside the confines and restrictions of what is normal. We are the creators, the writers, the artists, and the insane. Welcome to our Weird Realities.
Hello and welcome for a special episode of Watching Weird Realities, Inc., where film and pen meet. I'm Hadley Thorne, and tonight our panel is Morgana Calder and Mr. Joseph Hansen. And we're going to be talking with Mr. Joey Medea. Now, Joey has 31 years of teaching, writing, performing, and directing experience, and I'm super excited to call him a friend. Can't wait for y'all to get to know him better. Joey, thank you for being here today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
So, do you want to go ahead and just give a little background for Morgana and Joseph? I know you, so I kind of know a little bit about you.
I guess I was born knowing what I wanted to do, and I guess it's turned out that it was what I was meant to do. So I am a storyteller, and I like to tell story in as many different forms as I can. Because they're all unique and different, and I like that challenge. So that's why there's a lot of descriptors in my bio. I guess I'm primarily an actor and a writer who writes in for the stage, for the screen, for audio drama, for escape rooms, poetry, not so much anymore, but primarily novels, I guess, the written word. I do some short story, and I think that story is super powerful. I think if we want to make changes to ourselves, to the world, story is a good way to do it. So that's kind of my back. I've been lucky that I've been able to do it for a career for 31 years now.
It's incredibly impressive. You've got a 4-page resume, and it is so impressive. So
you got the short one, I think. my CV, I think my CV is 14 pages with my publication credits. And sometimes I'm amazed when I look back on it, but I get bored really easy. I don't like to be alone with my thoughts because I have so many of them. I rarely sleep. You know, I'm kind of that sort of prototype of the writer creator. You know, I remember reading about Jim Carrey when I was in my 20s, and I was like, wow, that's me. I get that. All these voices and characters and thoughts and ideas and parallel universes. And, you know, I'm a paranormal investigator. And that was totally unexpected when that happened a decade ago. I'm still trying to make sense of that and the experiences my wife and I have had. So yeah, it fills up a lot of pages when you're just going 24/7 for 30 years. It just sort of happens.
Well, it definitely does. And I see here you've got a web series too. Every day is a story all its own. It goes over the fundamentals of storytelling. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got started with that?
Yes. I am, I don't know where it is here in my office, but I have a painting of Socrates right before he drinks the hemlock. And as I was going through the educational system, I caught on pretty quickly that education is more about not learning or unlearning or learning only what you're supposed to learn. So I kind of made it my mission early on to provide an alternative. And I didn't want to be a school teacher because then you're entrenched in the system. I certainly didn't want to be a college professor because of the bureaucracy, the politics, and all that. So I dropped out of graduate school. But what I could do is I could offer the arts. I could offer acting, writing, directing, storytelling, improvisation as a way to not only create and share the arts, but to tell your story, to tell a collective story, to tell a community story. So before social justice sort of became, I don't know, a dirty couple of words or sort of got changed over the years, let's say, that's what I did. So we told stories about drug and alcohol abuse, and we told them very honestly. The first version of the play that I wrote for drug and alcohol abuse, I had a girl who sold her body for crack and was thrown out of a hotel window into a dumpster. That did not make it into schools, but it is a version of the story. So every day is a story all its own. I have a book coming out next year with that title I've been working on for about 10 or 12 years. And really, it's about how to tell your story, how to tell other people's stories, and to tell them well so that people pay attention. Because religion, politics, all these sort of bastions of society, the media, they are very, very good at telling story. So I think that we, the average citizen, should be at least as good at telling story as they are. And that means understanding it, breaking it down to its fundamentals. And then, so that's that.
Well, I can tell you're very passionate about it.
It's, you know, I 2 years ago, I was part of a group email thread. It wasn't 2 years ago. It was about five years ago. It was the previous change in presidential leadership sparked all of this stuff in the arts community, that if your art isn't for social change, it's worth nothing. It's not worth doing. It's not legitimate anymore. I don't believe that. I think that art can be escapism, and we all need that. We all need to just step away. And I have a stack of novels, you know, on my nightstand that I read because they're interesting stories and it's an alternative world. And yeah, okay, maybe I'm learning something, but it's a way to get away. Movies are certainly that. Lots and lots of movies are that. But I do think in this day and age, do you remember 5-6 years ago when we weren't constantly talking about politics? Like, what were we talking about?
Shark attacks.
Yeah. So that's the whole story thing and why it's real, real important to me now, because it helps. It helps people to tell their story. And I learned that very poignantly with the paranormal investigation and being an experiencer. And my wife is a psychic medium, so we spend lots of time with the dead. And primarily the dead want to tell their story, just like your average person that you sit down to next to on the bus or the train or plane. Well,
and that brings me to a question I have about the film that you did in, was it the penitentiary or was it an asylum that you did a film in? Am I wrong?
No, I think you're mixing up a couple of different things.
Okay.
Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum, which is in Weston, West Virginia, called the Weston State Hospital when it was no longer proper politically correct to call it the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum. But when it was founded in the 1860s, just post-Civil War, that's what it was called. And people have probably heard of it, lots of your listeners, because it's been on lots of television reality shows. But for 2 years, we were the house theater company there. So it gave me an opportunity to write a bunch of interesting things. So I wrote a one-man Edgar Allan Poe because I thought, what a cool place, a former mental institution for Poe's narrators and for his investigator, Auguste Dupin, to tell his story. And then at the very end of the night, about an hour and 15 minutes in, out comes Poe himself to answer questions from the audience about his life. So I created that show, and then I created Three Gothic Doctors and Their Sons, which is a novel. Next year, it's going to go up in LA as a stage musical and also as a hybrid film. I know we're going to talk about that in October. Hadley, specifically about that book. So I don't know how much you want to talk about that tonight. So Trans-Allegheny was interesting. I created a couple murder mystery musicals where the audience voted on the ending. I did a lot of really cool stuff in a very neat. Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum is the second largest hand-cut stone building in the world after the Kremlin. So it's a really interesting place. For people to check out.
It sounds amazing.
It is. It is very active. Very, very active. My wife had a phantom ice pick lobotomy there.
Oh, well, that doesn't sound good.
No, no. Well, there was this guy.
What the hell is that?
Okay, so great question. So I can tell you. I forget the doctor's name, but his name was Dr. Lobotomy. And he would tour around with, you know, his ice pick tool when frontal lobotomies became the thing. And of course, they go in through the eye. And he would do hundreds of these a week. He would just drive around to the different facilities and be doing this to people. And my wife, they gave us a hallway off a room.
Now, this was back when all the cough medicine was laced with cocaine, right?
Probably that same time period. Yeah, probably a little later.
They weren't feeling it anyway. So.
There you go. Well, my wife certainly felt it. And so we're in the hallway, which is kind of acting as our dressing room. And some weird things happened that day. A cigar rolled off a table and six of us saw it snap in half on the way to the ground. That was very interesting. But she was kind of bored. She had seen the play and, you know, we were prepping for the show, running lines and all, as actors do. So she wandered off by herself, which, you know, we've learned in very active places, especially if you're sensitive or a psychic, you don't go by yourself. It makes you vulnerable. It's just like walking in a bad neighborhood at night, right? Strength in numbers. And she got this shooting, searing pain through her eye into her brain that triggered a massive headache for several hours. The interesting thing is there's an episode, this was maybe a year later, we were watching an episode of one of the paranormal reality shows, and the same thing happened to one of the people on camera. So that was an interesting confirmation, because we weren't paranormal investigators at that time. And so we hadn't gone public with that information. So that was a weird, but definitely a cool place to check out. Rebecca Gleason runs it. You can mention my name and let her know you heard about this on Weird Realities. And a fascinating place.
And see, that's where I was going to jump in, because everybody that investigates has something that was the catalyst. So is it the fact that your wife was a sensitive, or was there a specific incident, do you think?
No, there was definitely a specific incident. So when Tanya was younger, she lived on Fort Meade. Her father was worked for NSA through the Air Force. Mm-hmm. And this was in the 1970s. And she had experiences. Weird things would happen. She would hear voices. She would feel someone sitting on her bed. The heads would go missing from her Barbie dolls. Mm-hmm. And she would go back into the room and the heads were back. All kinds of strange stuff. But what happened was in 2009. And we were in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. This weekend should be the Mothman Festival. But because of COVID, it's been canceled for the second year in a row. But we went down there to visit in 2009. We had loved the movie Mothman Prophecies with its Mark Pellington film.
Yep.
Terrific soundtrack. One of the best things Richard Gere's ever done. Laura Linney's in it. And Will Patton, actors I absolutely love. It's a fascinating film. But about this weird thing called the Mothman. Very odd. So there's a museum about 3 hours from where we had built a house in a holler in northern West Virginia. And for about 2 years, I told my wife, I don't want to go. I'm not interested. I don't want to spend almost 3 hours in the car to see something called a Mothman Museum.
Right.
So she kind of said, let's just have a romantic weekend getaway at this cool little town on the Ohio River. So long story short, we go out to a very active area where in 1966, 1967, people saw this creature that a newspaper journalist dubbed the Mothman, mm-hmm. Which was, I think, a fledgling Batman character, is my understanding. And we had a weird experience, quite honestly. We felt there's a paranormal researcher who wrote the Mothman Prophecies book, nonfiction, named John Keel. And John Keel talked about something called the zone of fear. Mm-hmm. It's an irrational fear in a place where you should not feel fearful. And that's what we were feeling. It was beautiful. We're in a wildlife preserve. There's a beautiful lake. There's docks, a blue, 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 blue sky. And we couldn't wait to get out of there. We felt watched. We felt in danger. Now, I woke up. I grew up at the Jersey Shore in the Pine Barrens, home of the Jersey Devil and all, and would ride my bike for miles and miles and hours deep into the Pine Barrens. Always went camping, was always in the woods as a kid in old burned out houses and brick shells of buildings, and spent a lot of time by myself in spooky places. And I was so afraid, and it didn't make any sense. So we're driving back and we're trying to make sense of all of this. And we see something. It blinks out in front. It blinks into existence over the road about 10 feet up. It's this black elongated humanoid figure. And it blinks out in a blink of an eye at a cornfield. And we both turn to each other at the same time and say, did you see that? If we hadn't done that, if one of us or both of us hadn't done that, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation right now. And my life, I think, would be very different. We get back to town, and it's 2.5 hours later than it should be. So we were only about 15 minutes outside of town. So it took 15 minutes to get there. We stayed for no more than 10 minutes and we left. And so all the shops were closed and it should be around 3 o'clock. And instead it's like 5:15, 5:20, something like that. Mm-hmm. So one of the shopkeepers who had given us a map to the area opens up his door and we say, we got to tell you what happened to us. It was really, really strange. Now we drew what we saw without talking to each other about it first. And the pictures are almost identical. So they're in our book, Watch Out for the Hallway. It's really kind of astonishing. So that really set us on the path. A bunch of paranormal investigators heard about it. They were very intrigued. They were wondering, was it the Mothman? It wasn't the Mothman. It was the furthest thing from the Mothman. But there were time-space distortions. I saw a gas station that wasn't there, has never been there. We thought there were cornfields on both sides of the road. That's what we both independently drew. But there was only a cornfield on one side, and the other side, it was a house that had been there probably since at least the 1970s. So it was all very weird and disorienting. So we get to know all these paranormal investigators, and one of them, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, who before she died 2 years ago, wrote 65 books, was on every paranormal show, was a superstar in the field. And Rosemary tutored us for 10 years. She mentored us. Yeah. And then I mentioned Watch Out for the Hallway. We got the opportunity to investigate something called the Webb Memorial Library in North Carolina, in Moorhead City, North Carolina, on the Crystal Coast, Southern Outer Banks. We went in there for 150 hours over 75 nights over 2 years. And we brought over 500 guest investigators with us. So we were in it pretty deeply by then when the book came out. A lot of people learned about it. But when we had that experience in 2009, shortly after, Tanya had her Reiki 3 attunement. So Reiki is a Japanese energy modality. And oftentimes when people get those attunements, they're sort of rewired. So between that and whatever happened to us, Tanya all of a sudden had dead people showing up all the time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, especially when she was with her clients, but then they would show up in our home. We found out our daughter was a pretty talented psychic medium. So she had her first experience with ghosts in a graveyard in Arkansas when she was 5. Mm-hmm. She's extremely gifted. And October, November of 2020, at the urging or the strong suggestion of a radio host, we underwent regression hypnosis and found out that, believe it or not, we were abducted by aliens, classic grays and another weird creature that I saw. And they did some psychological experiments on me. They did some very kind of gentle, you know, not at all the Betty Barney Hill kind of trope of long needles or Travis Walton, nothing like that. So between all of that, our sensing centers were kind of opened up. And I always say the paranormal was investigating us, so we were going to investigate it back.
Yeah.
And that's been 12 years now that we've been doing that.
Cool. Yes, regression is on my bucket list.
It's perfectly safe when done right. So we had never thought of it because I think we were skeptical about it. Mm-hmm. You can implant ideas with your questions. You can certainly lead with questions.
Right.
But Tanya, at the time, she got her certification in past life regression and hypnosis from the Edgar Cayce Institute. So she got certified in hypnosis, got that certificate first, and then specialized in soul contact and past life. So we kind of knew it was safe in the right hands, and we were able to handpick people who we really trusted, mm-hmm. and had the recordings that we sent to 8 or 10 paranormal investigators, because I was shocked. We were already the people who saw ghosts and spirits and wrote this book about, you know, this 2-year investigation of this library. And now we find out that, you know, there was this gray alien abduction scenario. I thought that people were going to go, these people are obviously nuts. They're obviously looking for attention, and they're a little cuckoo. And it's time we say goodbye to the Medeas. And so we sent this out and we said, please tell us we're crazy. Tell us the questions were faulty. Tell us it's kind of analytical overlay, as they say in the remote viewing world. Mm-hmm. And they all came back independently and said, no, this is solid. This is sound. We mm-hmm. believe this. I have this picture here. I know a sketch artist who's been on Dead Files and is a really talented artist. And he wanted to hear it. He's not a paranormal investigator, but he's curious. So I sent him the audio, and from what I described, this is what he drew.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, wow.
So this is the thing I saw. So it's mostly deer or elk. It's a little bit goat as you get closer, mm-hmm. And a whole lot of alien when you get real, real close. So back behind me is my owls are not what they seem from Twin Peaks. And there is this idea of screen memories where we see things that we can accept when we see things that our mind can't accept. Mm-hmm. So what the hell was this thing? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. And that keeps me showing up. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. And that's me. I've been doing research for most of my life, I guess. And it's the same thing. It really just opens up more questions.
Yes.
You know, just when I think, okay, I'm almost there, it's like, ooh, let's go over here now, you know, because mm-hmm. something always leads me to something else. You know, I think the first past life memory I have was from when I was about 5. And it was having nightmares about a battlefield, you know. Mm-hmm. And then when I was in grade school 3 or 4 years later, of all things, you know, I had a library card in first grade. I think I was the only kid in my town that did. But I found one of those Fodor's type books that you use for traveling.
Yes.
And there was a photograph in there of Culloden in Scotland. And I just broke into tears because I recognized the landscape, you know. And like I said, I mean, you know, and it's kind of been that way with me. Just, you know, one thing on top of another. But it's that validation is huge, huge, you know. And everything. But, you know, when you're 5 years old and you've got people with swords and cannon and all this other stuff, you know, all you know is people are dying, you know.
Wow. So one of my book series is The Cannon and the Quill.
Uh-huh.
And I bring this up because so when we moved down to North Carolina and this kind of pulls everything together in a way, all the different aspects of my life. That's where the library is. But I was always fascinated with pirates. I was always fascinated with the archetype. And I look like a pirate. So I got the opportunity to become creative director for a touring company that that's where we got involved with the web library and during that investigation over the 2 years and all of that. But I created a character and his name is Angus McGregor. And he's the nephew of Rob Roy McGregor, the famous cattleman and outlaw in the Scottish Highlands there. Mm-hmm. And this is my photo of me. There's Angus by the sea there.
Uh-huh.
And so Angus became a big hit. I got to do Japanese television show. They sent a crew over from Japan to film the show and have been in all kinds of magazines, and it's a stage show. We just got the artwork for the third book in the trilogy. So the first one is We All Be Jacobites Here. And the second one is Princes of the World. And the third one is called How to Be a Proper Pirate. But the reason that I bring this up at this exact moment is Angus's son, and Angus has a vision of this in book two in a scrying mirror, fights at Culloden.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I'm very interested that you have memories of that. Oh, that's wild.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, oh, you wow. meet the people you're supposed to when you're supposed to.
Absolutely, and Hadley's a master of bringing together people who are supposed to be together.
Cat herder. That's what we've called her for years.
Yeah.
That's
wrangling good. Those cats. I'm good at it.
Yeah.
So that's amazing.
Mm-hmm. And that's
I live up in the Midwest, and it's just too cold for ghosts up here. You know, the most we get is when you have a relative die, they come back as a cardinal. You know, and you don't want to talk about it at church because that might mean, you know.
Are you in Michigan by any chance?
No,
he's in Minnesota. Oh, he's a Viking.
Minnesota. Oh, cool! Very cool. Yeah, one of my
Budapest and Lefsa. Matter okay. fact, I live in the town now. Hold on to your seats. I live in the town that is famous for cooking the world's largest Lefsa.
Now, what is Lefsa?
A city block big.
What is a lefse?
Lefse is like a potato tortilla that the Swedish make.
Wow.
You smear it with butter and sprinkle a little sugar on it and ooh. Roll it up, and it is just fabulous.
I would eat that.
That sounds amazing. Yeah, no, I was asking because Michigan, you know, has the dog man and like many cryptids. Sure. I cannot offhand, and I'm by no means an expert, but I can't think of a cryptid associated with Minnesota.
Yeah, there's not much. I mean, we get a Ouija boards up here now and again, but you know, somebody's parent usually makes them throw that away. Yeah. You finally contact someone, and your mom's like going, "Get that the hell out of my house."
I don't know when it's too cold for ghosts.
A Ouija board that it was just kind of, if you had one, you had a label. You know,
uh-huh.
It's just really strange, but
yeah.
But you know, Minnesota, I love Minnesota. It's a great place to grow up. I've lived here all my life. I love to fish here. And with multimedia and Amazon, I'm able to get my message out in the books I write, because I've been writing for over 35 years. And, you know, and I like long epic tales. I sent one to Hadley that like 300,000 words. And
he's got some amazing books. Tell them about your book, Sunny.
Sunny was my first release, and I was in a critique writing group where we just criticized everybody. You know, you'd read it and you criticize it, and nobody was allowed to get hurt feelings or anything because it was open, honest criticism, and there wasn't any ego involved. And I really, really love that. I also took a course there called The Keys, which really opened my eyes to Shakespeare's input into writing in acts and scenes and development of the play and how we still write like that today. However, we write so fast today that what he planned for a whole presentation is now done each chapter, you know?
Yep.
So it almost gets to be too much, right. Cousin Sonny was titled that originally, but I rewrote it and re-released it as Sonny. And it's the chimp is the protagonist, and cool. He speaks sign language, and he was a bushmeat orphan, if you know what that is.
Yes.
And this professor rescued him and brought him home. The laws in the 60s when he was brought home, or 70s when he was brought home, there weren't really any about bringing a chimp. So he wasn't here illegally, but nobody really knew he was here. And the professor dies. And at the same time he dies, he was in a meeting with a social worker for a chimpanzee rescue center because he was trying to find a home for Sonny. And anyways, he gets lost in a university overnight because they bring him there for research. She thinks he's been drugged because he was into gene splicing and such like that. But anyways, he gets picked on by some janitors, and he goes crazy and tears someone's face off and is on the run. But it's through his point of view, and it's trying to show how you know, he is hated and he is thought to be a murderer, and he just has such a sweet, honest nature, and he's so confused about why he's being, you know, and it's just, it's one of my favorite stories to this day. And I honestly feel that something else was inside me when I wrote it, because it's like nothing else I've written. I mean, I've written some good stuff, okay? Leave it to me to be humble, but I've written some really good stuff. But nothing quite strikes you as Sonny does. You know?
When I heard you talk about it, I knew I had to read it. I love stories like this, and I knew that I had to read it.
I have to. So I spend a lot of time on your guys' side of the microphone because I have my own show, or with my wife. So I'm going into interview mode here. I saw the announcement that you're one of the featured authors on Horror Writers Inc. now. Yep. So I spent some time on your Amazon page, and I was just gauging by the covers, I was amazed by the length and width and breadth of the subjects that you write about. So I'm looking forward to breaking the ice with your stuff. But I have to say, too,
and vice versa. I had never heard of you, but I'm going to pick up your stuff now, because some of the things you talk about, I know I'm old, but I'm very open-minded. Some of the stuff you talk about and really interests me. And you know, I'm not into the paranormal stuff, but I am interested in people's perception of paranormal. Well, and, you know, I'm a horror writer, so I love a good horror tale.
Yeah.
Well, in addition to the paranormal stuff, Joey's written an incredible book called Three Gothic Doctors and Their Sons. Oh, Joey, if you'd like to tell Joe about that, I'm sure him and Morgana would love to hear it.
I've got a list of books going.
So Three Gothic Doctors and Their Sons. Let's see. Well, hold on. I got to go backwards and address Sonny for just a second.
Oh, please.
When I was a kid, the two movies that emotionally moved me, and I'm a crier. I cry at everything. It's part of the experience, the viewing experience. I love story. King Kong and Mighty Joe Young. Because here is someone who is pulled from their natural habitat where they belong. They are in scale. The world is built to suit them because they're unique. And they're pulled out of that world by greedy moneymakers. Yep. And they're made to suffer. They look like the villains. Yep. And so when Mighty Joe Young dies and when King Kong dies, I hope I'm not spoiling anything for younger viewers. I would cry and like the injustice of it. So I gotta read Sonny, but.
And I always loved, I was older, so I loved Curious George. And the original Tarzan were awesome.
But yes.
Anyways, I want to hear about your book.
But I do love that.
Is it on Audible?
No, not yet. I haven't had time. You know, it's really, I do some voiceover work, and there's a book coming out that I have, but it's so much work to make a really good audiobook, the hours.
You know, I found a new guy, Neil Arango. I used him on my Gone to Dog series, and I'm using him on my Splinter. And he's very talented in different voices, real down to earth, a new father, and, you know, he's really great.
Cool. I mean,
our politics are different, but who cares, you know?
Yeah.
If you're kind of East Coast too, so
absolutely. Yeah, I'm from Jersey. There's no hiding it. So especially when I get excited, I'm always excited when I'm talking about story. So Three Gothic Doctors and Their Sons. I think there's a crossover here with or a continuation of King Kong and Mighty Joe Young. So the three Gothic doctors are Doctors Moreau, who is the least well known of all the great Gothic doctors, but Moreau, Frankenstein, and Jekyll. And so when we were creating, it all kind of comes full circle here. When we were creating Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum programming, I said, you know, what if one ambitious surgeon in the early, you know, Edwardian, so pre-World War II, but we've gone through World War I, and there's this ambitious surgeon. What if he was able to collect the journals of Frankenstein, Moreau, and Jekyll and say, I'm going to take their combined knowledge and my own genius and all the mistakes that they made, and I'm going to pick up their work, but I'm not going to screw it up. And so that was the premise. And I pitched it to the asylum, and I wrote it as a stage musical. because I, you know, Frankenstein's monster is like Mighty Joe Young or like King Kong. He's a character who's an other that didn't choose. He didn't choose to be created. Yeah. And the hubris and same thing with Mr. Hyde, right? Mr. Hyde didn't choose to come forth out of.
And Godzilla.
Well, and Godzilla, right. All these different creatures. And Moreau's monsters, right? To make these human animal hybrids, and they're in pain, and he's the lawgiver. And so I have this really overdeveloped sense of justice.
Which is kind of what Sonny's about, because Sonny never chose to be in the situation.
Right.
It was forced upon him. Yeah. And he just doesn't know how to deal with it.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of resonance here. So that's what Three Gothic Doctors is mostly about. So in the stage musical, we said, well, how are we going to do this? So it begins, and I'm not going to take you through the whole thing beat for beat, I promise. But it does begin with this scientist, Robert Walton, busting into Moreau's island laboratory. And it's been years. It's a nice, good visual. You know, it's all quiet and it's this dusty laboratory and this door busts open and he comes in and he reads the journals and kind of talks to and gets information from Jekyll and Frankenstein and Moreau. So we replay each thing. So we did it with two actors. And I got to play Frankenstein's monster, Mr. Hyde, and the Sayer of the Law, which was very cool to tackle those three characters in an evening. And it had songs and all that. It has a big twist. And it's been picked up for the stage, a bigger expanded version. We did it as like a 1 hour, 1 hour, 15 minute piece. It's going to be a full on 2 hour musical in Los Angeles. And they're going to tape it. And then they're going to turn it into a film based on the taping and the camera angles and all, which is kind of cool. But it's part of something that I call the Stanton Chronicles. And I'll just read you the couple lines about the Stanton Chronicles. The Stanton Chronicles combines extensive historical research with mystery and the paranormal to weave a fact-based fantasy of global empire and the multinational corporations and secret organizations that have ruled it from time immemorial. So the pirate series is that. So very steeped in historical fact. I've spent 6 years now with the Pirates of the Golden Age, which is Blackbeard's time. He's the canon, and Angus MacGregor is the quill. He's the chronicler, the storyteller. Cool. So there'll be about 7 books in that series. So that's Three Gothic Doctors. Hadley, I think you're reading it, right?
Yes, I am. Slowly, but I'm reading it.
You're enjoying it. It's written very much in that sort of Victorian, like the language is very rich. The sentences are a little complex. I really love that time period. And then there's 2 other books in the series. In February, a Sherlock Holmes book comes out, which is any Sherlock Holmes fans out there?
Yeah,
definitely.
Definitely.
So Sherlock Holmes, of course, did lots of short stories, 52 of them, but he did 4 novellas, the most famous of which is The Hound of the Baskervilles. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which breaks, it's not like the other 3 novellas. The other 3 novellas, at the end of the 2nd act, there's a flashback, oftentimes to America. So this is the Sign of the 4, Valley of Fear, and those kinds of things. So I said, well, what if I do a Sherlock Holmes, but I don't tell it from his point of view? I tell it from a point of view of the journalist. So Hadley, it's Judah Stanton who tells the story in Three Gothic Doctors. And this is years before, and he was in the army with John Watson. And so he tells the true story about how Holmes treated Watson and what he was really like, because Watson really kind of soft-pedaled and whitewashed just how horrific Holmes could be. So, but I said, what I want to do is I want to have a Gothic Western. So
that's cool.
Conan Doyle was fascinated with, you know, one of the stories is in Utah. It's about the Mormons. I think that's Valley of Fear. And I was like, so I want to do a Gothic Western. And I had tremendous fun with that. But I had an opportunity how how the Sherlock Holmes book came out was before my publisher died 2 years ago, she was putting an anthology together. And this came up, Hadley, when we were brainstorming anthology ideas. Sherlock Holmes meets the paranormal. Because even though Arthur Conan Doyle was the grandfather of paranormal research, Holmes was very, very skeptical. Is very, very skeptical. And so then I said, oh, well, Sherlock Holmes with Gothic horror, why don't I do a Dracula prequel? So in the Gothic Western, it's the backstory of Quincy Morris.
Oh.
Who's the cowboy in Dracula.
Awesome.
Okay. Yeah. And totally off subject, but not.
Okay.
Just recently, there was a book released by Stoker's grandson, great-grandson, and J.D. Barker called Dracul. Oh my gosh. I knew some of the backstory about the fact that they wouldn't publish, you know, the first part of Dracula because of the fear they thought that it would, you know, get going and everything. Yeah. And it kind of shows it in from several points of view.
Yes.
And a very interesting book. If you haven't read it, I do highly recommend it.
I read it. It was It's one of the last books I've read. Uh-huh. And it was really good.
Yeah.
Loved it. I read it as soon as it came out, because this whole sort of idea that maybe Stoker like really had met a vampire and there's weird, you know, things that are taken out. I love that sort of push fact in fiction.
Yes.
Where's the line? I mean, that's what I'm doing with the Stanton Chronicles. The third book, well, there's a surprise in the Sherlock Holmes book. It's a prequel to another classic horror story too.
Awesome.
But it hinges on the term, so I can't. I told the HWI anthology people, but they should probably be hopefully sworn to secrecy. But the third book in this series is Jack the Ripper.
Okay.
Oh.
And a book that came out. This is a really odd. Okay, so this is really a very odd book. It's called Minor Confessions of an Angel Falling Upward. And I believe that this came out in 2012, that very odd Mayan calendar year. And it's sort of a post-post, I market it as a post-post modern fallen angel vampire novel. And if you can see, it's written by someone named Planner Forthright.
Uh-huh.
And I edited it. Obviously Planner Forthright is me, but I don't know. You're all writers. You hope that all characters speak to you on some level, tell you what they want to happen in the story. If you're getting something wrong, they kind of correct you and all, you know, Pirandello's six characters in search of an author, all that kind of thing. But Planner was so strong and so in my head and put me on such a journey. I kid you not. It was originally serialized by a website called Legion in the early 2000s. And I was churning out this weird stuff. I was doing a lot of meditating, astral traveling, lucid dreaming, all this kind of stuff, creating what I called new mystic alchemy poetry. It was very stream of consciousness and all. And through this channel, through this kind of opening of this art experimentation that I was doing, totally drug-free, although most people ask me, like, am I drinking absinthe or smoking opium or something? But totally drug-free, but all through this sort of natural, you know, journeying and breath control and things like that. This character named Planner Forthright comes through and he talks to me very strongly. And nothing weird. I don't think he exists really. But he, so that was his book. That was his story. So Hadley, I don't know if you're there yet, but he makes an appearance in Three Gothic Doctors.
I don't think I've gotten there yet, but okay, I look forward to it.
Yeah, he's something to look forward to. And
the best book of yours to start with?
Oh, wow. Great question.
It sounds like they're all kind of connected.
They are all connected. I would say Minor Confessions is one of those books where 50% of the people say, I want to teach it in my college class. This is the most amazing thing. It reminds me of, and they list off all these great authors that I admire who are kind of obscure, sort of out there. And then 50% of the people, including my mom, go, I got 10 pages into it. I got 15 pages into it. This guy repulses me and I'm not reading this book. So
my wife doesn't read my work either.
Now this is my mom who reads mostly all my work after it's published. But I would, if you're at all interested in pirates, I would probably start with the cannon and the quill.
Okay.
Because it starts in the 1700s, it lays the groundwork. And I created a family called the Ravenscalds. And so there's all this cool, you know, like I was talking about multinational corporations and secret organizations. You know, there's this whole great, huge mythology in the world that Paul Christopher and Dan Brown and all these other guys write about, which is fascinating, right? The Knights mm-hmm. Templar and the Freemasons and, mm-hmm. you know, and then you got the Bilderberg Group, the Club of Rome. You got in California, you got the big thing with the giant owl, the secret thing that goes on out there in California. But what if there was a family that rose to power in like 1000 AD, the time of the Vikings, mm-hmm. the home of Minnesota, the Vikings, get to those roots. And they control everything. They control politics. They own the Vatican. They own high technology. They own weaponry. They architect wars and they play both sides. So that whole Weisenhoff's Illuminati thing. But what if it was all kind of real? What would that mean? And how would all these things intersect? So they're introduced.
Yeah, there are people claiming like the Rothschilds and things like that.
Yeah, well, that, you know, we
so many years. And the DuPonts, yeah. I know they were yes. on in France in the 1700s. And,
yeah.
You know, is it true? I don't know. I can't perceive of wanting to control people that much myself.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah. there are people that it's an obsession for them.
Yeah, and I'll tell you this, and of course, it's been a great success for Dan Brown and Paul Christopher and people like that. Brad Meltzer, who wound up with a TV show, right? But he started writing this fiction. It's a ton of fun to write about. Tanya and I are really hooked on the CBS show Evil.
Oh, yeah, that one's good.
and it's like first season to second season, it's a whole new puppy. You know, the first season was kind of fun. It was a little mundane. The monsters were kind of hokey. But the second season, it's like off the hook crazy. I'm like, I can't believe this is CBS. This is like HBO on acid. It's nuts. We just watched an episode before we came out when we were hooked. I'm trying to decipher the titles and the mm-hmm. codes. So I'm doing all. My dad was a cryptographer in the Naval Security Group, and I have some of his code love. But it's also fun to write about. So if you're at all into pirates, I would start with The Cannon and the Quill, book one. Otherwise, Three Gothic Doctors. If you just like that Victorian, Edwardian, Gothic, you know, Jekyll, Frankenstein, mad scientist, all the tropes are there. So that might be the place to start. And then you could follow up with the Sherlock Holmes book, with the Gothic Western and all that. And then the Jack the Ripper. So I was talking about Minor Confessions. Mm-hmm. There's a section in Minor Confessions where I come up with a very unique, I'm a Ripperologist. If something interests me, I deep, 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 deep dive. So mm-hmm. for years, I've been looking into the Ripper thing. Well, why are there so many viable candidates,
yep.
right?
Yep, so, absolutely.
Patricia Cromwell, you know, spent $1 million of her own money saying mm-hmm. it was Walter Sickert. And then there's Donston, who's very interesting and could very well have been him. But there's all these people. And then there was Muggett, had the HBO show a couple of years ago. Oh, my grandfather was Jack the Ripper.
Uh-huh.
And he was the guy who had the murder hotel in Chicago.
Right.
The murder hotel in Chicago makes an appearance in the Three Gothic Doctors.
Oh.
Also, the serial killer Albert Fish, who among serial killers, this guy was cuckoo. So he's like Albert Fish. If you don't know Albert Fish, look him up or just read Three Gothic Doctors, and it describes him. But he was into kids. He was into cannibalism. He was into Satanism. He was into self-harm. It's like take every serial killer in history, and they all resided in Albert Fish, who said that the devil was possessing him. Well, mm-hmm. I'm kind of giving this away a little, but it's still worth reading. What if, and it's in Minor Confessions, what if there was a demonic spirit who possessed all of the key Jack the Ripper suspects. That would explain the different handwritings in the letters, the fact that letters were posted from numerous places. Now, in real life, we know that most of the letters, including the Dear Boss letter, were written by journalists to sell newspapers. And that's come out more and more. And plus, there were copycats and all that kind of stuff we know from serial killers. But what if there was this demonic entity that went from man to man for different purposes? And that's what the Jack the Ripper book is about. But again, because of my overinflated sense of social justice, you have newspaper sensationalism, definitely applies to today. Women being harmed, right? So when you watch things about the Yorkshire Ripper, like women were told like not to go outside. And with a lot of these serial killers, prostitutes are totally vilified, right? It's their fault and they deserve it. So there's all these great overlapping things that I'm going to put in the story. And it's also the police. It was the beginning of forensic police work. So the Jack the Ripper time. And do you guys know that while Jack the Ripper was killing those five women, do you know what was playing at the Lyceum Theater in London? Anybody know?
What?
The stage play of Jack the stage play of Jekyll and Hyde. And the guy who played Jekyll and Hyde, I forget his name now, the actor, he was so good that people were telling the police, "That's Jack the Ripper. He's on stage every single night." And they investigated this guy.
I have a question. Yeah. When you were talking about creating your character, are you saying that you would, like, there's more than one human person that is Jack the Ripper, yet only one demon that he got?
Yes. Yes.
Would that what you were? Okay.
Yeah, it's Occam's razor, right? The simplest explanation is the truest. So why are all these, you know, because you have retired New York police officers, you have journalists, you have Scotland Yard specialists, you have criminal psychologists, forensic psychologists, novelists who traffic in this stuff, serial killer experts, and they all have a different suspect that holds water. It's almost impossible. So I'm taking writing license. And so that'll come out in February of 23. I'm really excited about that one because it ties in with Jekyll and Hyde. It ties in with the whole Victorian. You know, I'm going to bring us slashingly into the 20th century. And he really did. Jack the Ripper I think there were 8 murders. Honestly, I think Martha Tabram was one, and I think there were some practice murders, and there might have been one after. So I believe that there's 8. I'm from that camp.
Okay, so when we do our Horror Writers Inc. murder mayhem and methodology, you're going to be vested when we do Jack the Ripper. I'm taking it.
Please hold a spot for me.
I will.
Yes, please. And I don't want to. You know, it's funny because I. You know, I play a pirate and I write about pirates, Jack the Ripper. I don't want to, like, you know, serial killers are an interesting thing, right? Because we're fascinated by them. My daughter was like 12 years old and she's like, "Dad, I'm reading your serial killer books." I'm like, "Okay, well." But we are. And they cross economic and race and age, and everybody's fascinated by serial killers. But we don't want to glorify them. Any True. More than we want to glorify pirates, you know, because some of them were just rapists and murderers.
Label on them, like
So when
to be someone like that, you probably have to be so many personalities throughout your life in order to do that and to be accepted socially, yet at the same time keeping your best friend's thigh in your freezer for a late night snack, you know. Who you are now. I know they've proven that there's no such thing as multiple personalities, and I think that's true in the unconscious sense, but I think that we all have multiple personalities. And I think a serial murderer like that has developed theirs to the point where they don't even know who they are at that time, you know.
I agree. And are there triggers you put on a certain something, a certain piece of clothing or a certain something or a pair of eyeglasses or we're watching Carnival now.
Oh,
you remember the
one.
Old HBO show Carnival?
Yeah.
So I have this theory where we're only one episode into the first season, but Clancy Brown does a great job as the preacher.
Yes.
And but I have found a correlation between when he wears glasses and when he holds his glasses. And I think it's a trigger for what part of his personality or whatever is coming out. Right. So I look for those kind of things. I do historical drama, one man shows under something called Chautauqua. And at the end of the show, what I love about it is you do a 50-minute piece as a character, and then you answer questions for 15 minutes as the character, and then you answer 15 minutes as the scholar and researcher. And the trigger from the character to the scholar researcher is to take off some key piece of your costume. So I'm very into that kind of thing. But hey, Richard Ramirez, right? The Night Stalker. If anybody looked like he was possessed by the devil, it was that dude.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Weird. And that's all tied into the Cecil Hotel and all that kind of crazy stuff. So. Yeah.
Zoe, I'm going to cut it there. We're right out of an hour.
Cool.
And I can't wait for you to come back next month, which I guess we'll probably just do the same thing again.
Okay. Sounds great. Okay.
Hey, Joey, it was awesome getting to know you. I hope to talk to you in the future. I think we have a lot in common.
Yes, sir. I agree. I'm honored to be. I am honored to be a Horror Writers, Inc. featured author with you.
Awesome.
So welcome aboard. It's a good group. Morgana, it was lovely to meet you.
Thank you also. I've enjoyed it.
You'll see more of her.
I hope to see more of you in the future.
Yeah, I'm coming out of my busy stage. I'm actually a graphic designer. So, you know, when schools start back, I'm really busy. But I'm coming off of most of that, so I hope to be on more.
Yeah,
cool.
I'm a building estimator now. So.
Oh, wow.
It's going like gangbusters. Doing a lot of design work. So just that year is just crazy.
Yep.
Well, Joey, can you tell our listeners where they can find you online?
Oh, yes, please. Seek me out on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that good kind of stuff. I have a big presence there. Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we have a show about the paranormal and spirituality and all these kind of cool things we're talking about with lots of really cool guests called Into the Outer Realms. So you can catch that on my Facebook page. And please get to know all these folks through Weird Realities, of course, where you're hooked into, but also Horror Writers, Inc., where Joe and Alan Gamboa and Hadley and just Jamie Hernandez and many, many awesome writers are there. So you can connect with me there, too. Yeah.
And if you don't think we're so great, we're going to convince you otherwise.
That's right.
Or we'll just talk to each other. So thank you so much for this opportunity.
I'm going to wrap it up, but hold on for a minute afterwards.
Okay. So will do.
That's going to do it, guys. I hope you've enjoyed our conversation with Joey Medea. Until next time, know that the team here at Weird Realities appreciates your support. And until we see you again, stay weird.